The next case on the Northern Panel's docket this morning is Strange Land, Inc. versus the Second Judicial District Court, Seneca Insurance Company. It's real party in interest, case number 71758. Welcome, counsel. Nice to see all of you. Please proceed.
Thank you.
I can't help but say, please forgive me, Mr. Dreisler, but I haven't seen Kevin in so long. I just have to say hi, Kevin. My gosh, it's been a long, long time.
It has been. It's good to see you.
I'm glad you have. I mean, it's only been, what, 16 years since I've been on the court, or 19. I'm glad to see you here.
That I'm still practicing.
Yeah.
I hear from a lot of our contemporaries that there's, you know, that they say to me, are you still practicing? Oh, yeah, I am.
Go ahead.
Thank you. Justices, my name is Kevin Karp. I'm appearing on behalf of Strange Land. I am not the counsel that filed the briefs. That was Vern Leverty in his office. I've taken over the case since the briefs have been filed. But I am familiar with the briefs and with the case itself. And I'm going to keep it relatively short because I think the briefs are detailed almost to an extreme on both sides. And there's no reason for me to repeat what you've probably read multiple times already. But to state the issue succinctly, once Judge Freeman ruled that the clause of Seneca's insurance policy that is at the heart of their third cause of action, which is the only thing we're here about. Once Judge Freeman ruled that it was ambiguous, then isn't he obligated to interpret it against the insurance company that wrote it?
I have a fundamental question, Mr. Carpenter.
Certainly.
you rightly point out that what we're here about is the third cause of action. The question for me, and we have quite a bit of jurisprudence in this area, is whether this court should entertain this case or this writ where it doesn't dispose of all the remaining claims between the parties. Could you address why we should even entertain this petition?
The reason to entertain this petition is that even though it won't dispose of the entirety of the case, which I agree it won't, it will dispose of the issue involved in the third cause of action. And therefore, Department 9, and I'm sorry for thinking of it that way, but I really get, sometimes I get the department numbers confused after all these years. Department 9 won't be wasting, or counsel, and all the parties involved, won't be wasting time arguing the cause of action that is disposed of. It's useful in that while it won't dispose of the case, it will dispose of an issue that in and of itself could result in quite a lot of the court's time being, the lower court's time, being taken in the trial. And that's why it's still relevant, and I think it's still important.
If I understand your argument in this petition, it isn't that this is an issue of first impression or one of statewide importance. It's rather your view that the judge just failed to apply the correct legal standard with respect to ambiguity once he found ambiguity present. Is that fair?
That's the simplest way of putting it. I have read and reread his decision multiple times since I've gotten in this case, and I honestly do not understand Judge Freeman's reasoning. He seems to take the position that even though he finds that this is ambiguous, and even though he recognizes, obviously, that this is an insurance contract, and there's the law in that regard, I don't need to repeat because you're familiar with that, of course. Even though he finds all of that, he is taking the position that evidence is needed for him to determine how the ambiguity should be interpreted. If this was an ordinary contract between you and I, he'd be right. But you and I are not insurance companies. And the Nevada law is, not just Nevada, quite a few states actually, are quite clear that an insurance contract is an adhesion contract, and that in an insurance contract, the ambiguity, the law recognizes, the courts recognize that insurance contracts are written by the insurance company.
And so that, your position, Mr. Karp, is that, I take it, is that even though the petition does not raise an issue of first impression or of statewide importance, or statewide public policy, this is an error that should be corrected because it is so clear?
That is correct. I believe it's very clear. And every argument that Seneca makes against my argument is an argument that has nothing to do with the clause that we're talking about. Their arguments are that they think there might have been fraud in the inducement, for lack of a better term, that fraud in obtaining the insurance coverage in the first place. But their clause talks about, the clause in the third cause of action talks about fraud relating to a claim. And their interpretation is relating to a claim means when you got the insurance policy in the first place. That makes no sense. And the fact that, and I don't even have to worry about whether it makes sense because Judge Freeman found it was ambiguous. And so our point is quite simply, once he found it was ambiguous, then further evidence on a determination of it is unnecessary because as an insurance contract, the law speaks for itself as to what he was obligated to do as to the third cause of action.
Do you agree it's ambiguous?
Oh, absolutely.
Judge Freeman was correct.
Yeah. Well, actually, to a certain extent, to me it's pretty straightforward, but I have a completely different interpretation of it than Seneca. And so let's assume they're acting in good faith in their interpretation. Then if they're acting in good faith, then they have one interpretation of it, and I have one interpretation of it. And by definition, that means it's ambiguous. So while I don't think it's ambiguous, I think it's very clear. I think they're wrong in claiming there's another interpretation. But assuming good faith on their part, that confirms Judge Freeman's viewpoint that it's ambiguous. So what we're asking this court to do is to make a determination that indeed the ambiguity must be addressed pursuant to the Nevada law, and that as a result of that, Judge Freeman would be obligated to dismiss the third cause of action, and of course the case will continue to move forward on multiple other aspects of this case, including other parties that are not relevant to this proceeding. And I don't think I have anything else to say for opening, unless the court has any other questions for me.
I don't think so. Mr. Karp, you can reserve the remaining 8 minutes if you wish.
Thank you. I will.
Morning, Mr. Chrysler. How are you doing today? Good, thank you.
I have to bring the reading glasses. I thought I could get away without them, but I can't.
Yeah. Okay. I know the feeling.
May it please the court, my name is Richard Dreitzer. I'm counsel for the Real Party and Interest Seneca Insurance in this matter. We agree heartily with the court's initial response, which is that this matter is not appropriate for writ relief. We have a trial date of March of 2018. We have five causes of action. This issue deals with simply one of those. There have been summary judgments that have been filed and denied as to the other four. Those are all going to the jury. So we're here dealing with one cause of action only. So I think on that basis alone, it is appropriate for a writ not to issue. And simply, as I heard Mr. Karp say, because they're abandoning any public policy or any other matter of importance, I have been prepared to argue those issues as well, but if he's abandoning that, then that's fine. Substantively, the main issue from our perspective.
On occasion, granted a writ by order where the error was so clear and that error, the correction of that error was mandated by law.
Right.
And that seems to be the position that Mr. Karp takes today, that we should entertain the writ because how this court has previously interpreted the standard to apply in interpreting ambiguous clauses in insurance contracts is clear. So what is your view about that point?
Two basic responses. First of all, even if this court were to construe the exclusion as they would deem appropriate, which is limited strictly to the claims process, we have alleged in our brief, and the record contains evidence of alleged fraud in the claims process. So even if the court grants that writ and limits us to the small box of fraud of the claim, we have six instances by my count, and they're documented on page 9 of our brief, where we allege fraud as to the claim. And in subsequent discovery in the case, subsequent to the EUO and the denial of the claim, we've uncovered even more still fraud that we think fits neatly into that box of fraud related to the claim. So effectively, even if they win, they lose on that point. But also, I believe that the...
Could you clarify something for me?
Sure.
On page 4 of Judge Freeman's order, he identifies essentially why he feels that the phrase is ambiguous, and seems to be saying on the face of the policy it's susceptible to two reasonable interpretations, making it ambiguous. But for purposes of invoking this our court's jurisprudence with respect to the interpretation of insurance policies, we have made distinctions between latent and patent ambiguity. Which was it that the court found here?
I don't think the court was clear on what type of ambiguity it was dealing with. I mean, we believe it is a patent ambiguity in the sense that you need context in order to determine that there's ambiguity there. I think making things more complicated, the phrase that they've identified that they believe is ambiguous, is, and Judge Freeman sets on, is relating or related to a claim. But they ignore the language before that, which says at any time and relating to a claim. And so I believe that because that is open-ended from a temporal perspective, that creates, I don't agree with their interpretation of the ambiguity at all. I think, if anything, it's much more broad than they indicate. And so for Judge Freeman to come down that way, I think the judge was following jurisprudence as far as the interpretation of the contract. But in this sense, yes, you have to construe the language against the drafter. Yes, you have to deal with the ambiguity and construe it narrowly. And yes, you have to find the favor of coverage as a default position. I understand all that. But you also have to effectuate the reasonable expectations of the insured. And I think this is an issue of word choice, not of error. Because I think what the judge was saying when he refers to, I can't determine the intent of the parties, I think what he's saying is that it's a matter of he can't determine the reasonable expectation of the insured at the time of the inception of the policy, which under the case that he cites, the Mullis case, is an appropriate circumstance where you would deny some or fail to grant summary judgment until you get evidence on that fact. I'm not saying that the judge can't come down that way, but I think he has to have a trial first and determine what the facts are as to the reasonable expectations of the insured, and then at that point construe the exclusion and apply it appropriately. And we believe we have arguments which speak anything, if anything, to the opposite, which broaden it to, you know, relate at any time and relating to a claim, which we believe starts at the inception of the policy when the application was submitted, with regard to the underwriting process, the EUO that was done, and then the claims themselves. We think there's fraud at every stage of this thing. And so, you know, that's kind of how we look at it. And so I think the issue, as I said, is one of word choice and not of error, because the judge was simply trying to follow, as I can determine, as trying to follow the cases which say you have to have a reasonable understanding of what the expectations of the insured are at the time the policy was incepted in order to determine how to apply the exclusion. And so I think the judge got it right on that point, because we haven't had the trial yet and he can't say what the reasonable expectations were for the insured. And so I think also the cases that we cite in our brief with regard to the issue of related to and relating to, I think if anything cut against the interpretation urged by the petitioner. The Morales case that we cite and the Friedman versus Sebelius cases, those are federal cases, which say in context of other areas of law that relating to or related to must be construed broadly, that implies a broad effect. And so we think that, you know, if anything, the interpretation urged by the petitioner is incorrect for that point.
So, but then you say broad enough that it says relating to the claim. That means relating to the claim and the application and the inducement. I mean, that's how broad you'd have read relating to claim?
Justice Sigler, I would, and the reason I say that is because the phrase that comes before the words in it that they've centered on in the policy, it says at any time and relating to a claim. And so I think that, I mean, if it wanted to limit it as the time, and it could have said, you know, in a more limited way, but since it said at any time, to me, that reaches back to the inception of the policy. And it should reach back to the inception of the policy. And the reason I say that is NRS 687B110 codifies as a matter of public policy that we are not going to tolerate misrepresentations by an insured in connection with a policy of insurance at any stage of the process. And so we believe that this presents an issue of public policy, not in their favor, but against them, because the Nevada legislature and this court have held that we're not going to tolerate misrepresentations in connection with a policy of insurance wherever it may occur. That's statutory, and it's a felony to do so. And so we think that the interpretation of the exclusion, as we urge, follows directly along the lines of what the statute calls for, which is we are not going to tolerate any sort of misrepresentation in connection with insurance policy.
So you would have us read that, for that the sentence in question is a list at any time, and if it's related to a claim. That's how you'd have us read that. It's got to be a list, right? Because at any time, and that would be untethered to relating to a claim.
I believe that's correct. And we use certain language in our brief, which refer to, I don't have the language in front of me, but...
It's Latin, though. It sounds good.
we use certain terms in terms of the types of facts that we're looking at that we believe the exclusion applies to. But I believe that an interpretation, as you have indicated, falls directly in line with what the public policy of the state is. They have also urged that the court narrow the exclusion to only the facts that we were aware of at the time of the denial. And I think that too is improper, because we learned a lot more about the fraud in this case during the period of discovery, which has been over the last 18 months or so. And I would argue that it allows them to profit from their concealment if we are not allowed to bring that information in at the time of trial. We've learned a lot during discovery.
Can you tell me, as it exists in the record, just what type of concealment? I know you've listed a few things, but just to get it out clear and concisely, what particular concealments and fraud is it related to the claims that were presented here?
Absolutely.
Is it related to the boiler, for instance?
I'm happy to do so. I would draw the court's attention to the deposition testimony of Mr. Eli Kerr and the affidavit of Mr. Andrew Ardens, because when we did the EUO of Mr. Dobbs, he explained to us that the nature of the loss, the reason for the loss, was the failure of a pipe in a certain respect. Then we took the depositions of Mr. Ardens and Mr. Kerr, and they told an entirely different story about the nature of the loss. They said, Mr. Dobbs indicates it's a failure of a weld seam in a pipe. Mr. Ardens has said there was a rubber hose that was hooked to two sections of pipe by clamps, and that the rubber hose seam failed, and that's where the water came from. That we didn't learn any of that until we took the depositions of Mr. Kerr and we got the declaration of Mr. Ardens. So that directly contradicts what the insured has indicated was the basis for the loss in this matter. Which was that the leak was the result of a weld seam and not the result of self-help involving a rubber hose, which should
not. So that would be excluded under the declarations of policy.
We believe that the law should be excluded under
that. No. The self-help portion, rather than what was indicated, would be excluded as part of the policy declarations. No coverage would exist for that.
We certainly believe so. And so, but
and the declarations say that.
Yes, that is a non-code compliant fix for a boiler, and you can't expect an insurance company to pay for a loss where you use non-code compliant means of fixing that issue. But also, you have an obligation as an insurer to display the loss. You have an obligation to show your insurance company when you make a claim, here is why I have suffered this loss, and point to it and show us it. They gave us a section of pipe, but that is, with the weld seam as they claim it is, but that is directly contradicted by the testimony we obtained during discovery. And so it's the nature of the issue, which is the non-code compliant fix, but it's also the cover-up, you know, as they say.
Well, so you have to make the jump that they were aware of these exclusions in the policy when they were making those statements making therefore fraudulent statements.
Well, but I think it's pretty obvious that, and I should add something else, and this is crucial, and I'm sorry I didn't mention it before. After my witnesses, Mr. Kerr and Mr. Ards, observed the rubber hose that I mentioned, they were exiting the boiler room where this took place. And Mr. Dobbs, allegedly, according to my witnesses, said to these gentlemen, "You never saw that." So to me, that speaks to an intent to conceal, and that speaks to fraud.
So, Mr. Dreyfuss, are you saying it doesn't matter if we say relating to the claim or not, if we read it broadly, because there actually is fraud relating to the claim,
that's
evidence of it?
That's exactly correct. Exactly correct. And so I see that, Justice Paragraph, if you're struggling with, well, if you're concerned about what the intent was in making that statement, I think the comment to my witnesses, which each of them independently confirmed that you never saw that phrase, that speaks directly to an intent to conceal, which puts us in the category of fraud. If there's any doubt, I think that comment alone cinches it in our favor. And I know I'm mentioning pipes, so that's a bad pun there. Okay.
And there's been no bad faith action filed against the insurance company in this case?
Oh, there has. And this is a bad faith action that they have commenced against us. And we believe that, as I said, the fraud is basically replete from
top. Well, there's several actions pending. I guess Balfour didn't get paid after representations by the insurance company that they would be paid.
Well, actually, that's not quite accurate. There's no privity between my client and Balfour. The privity is between Mr. Dobbs' company, Strangeland, and Balfour. So he hired them after the loss. And so what they did or did not do, and what the nature of their actions, whether they were wrong or right or what have you,
okay, that's my mistake and my misunderstanding. Okay. I thought the insurance company referred Balfour to the...
No, Your Honor, that was strictly their responsibility. The other thing I'd like to say is with regard to the relief that was requested. Mr. Karp says that what they'd like the court to do is construe the ambiguity in the manner that they suggest and also dismiss the third cause of action. And I don't think you get there. I think even if we're wrong, and even if you can ignore at any time in relating to a claim, you can ignore the fraud that we've demonstrated in the claim, even if you come down to the exclusion the way they suggest, you still can't dismiss the cause of action. You have to send it back down for trial because there are issues of fact about, among other things, what I just described, what the parties knew with regard to the fraud in question, because we believe there was fraud. And so there's issues of fact to preclude summary judgment on that point. Let's see. The other thing I would suggest is if there's a concern about denying coverage for one reason while the loss relates to another, I wanted to speak to this. The Randono case is something I wanted to bring up, which is a gentleman who died of cancer, yet there was a concealment of a high blood pressure in his application, and the carrier denied coverage. This court upheld that denial, and I think that's consistent with what we're looking at here, which is wherever you find fraud or misrepresentations in connection with a claim at any point, it is appropriate for you to deny coverage regardless of how the loss got in front of you. We're dealing with a boiler loss, yet the fraud occurred in the context of the claims and also prior to it as well. And so we believe if Randono is dispositive, and we
did
also believe...
Did that have the same language, contractual language, as we have here?
It did not. It did not. But I would also urge the court to look at this from the standpoint of a word choice issue and not an error issue, because I think the judge was trying to effectuate the reasonable expectations of the insured. And with that, unless the court has questions, I'll take a seat.
Let me ask one more question. I'm sorry, Mr. Dreitzer.
Yes.
Did the when the court? I recognize you guys are in this, and it's been going on a long time.
Yes.
When the court made its ruling, had Seneca alleged fraud outside of the application process?
Absolutely.
They had. Okay.
Absolutely. Yes. Right. And in fact, our motion for reconsideration brought that up as well. So we have been shouting from the rooftops about what we've discovered ever since it came to pass.
Okay.
Thank you, sir. Justices, to a certain extent, what Mr. Dreitzer said confirmed a lot of what I've been saying, which is there's an ambiguity. The interesting thing about what he said to one extent is that, and it's funny how simple words can have different meanings to different people. The clause says any time and relating to a claim. He interprets it as at any time or relating to a claim. If the insurance company wanted to use the word or, we must assume they are perfectly capable of doing so. They wrote this.
Well, doesn't it relate to a claim anyway? Does it make any difference whether it's and or in this case?
Well, in this case it does, because the third cause of action, which is what we're here about, is specifically a cause of action that deals with a fraud relating to a claim for which they made no representation in the third cause of action. The third cause of action only talks about fraud in the inception. even though the cause of action is under this clause in the contract. While Mr. Dreitzer likes to talk about fraud that they claim they've discovered since then, and I dispute it wholeheartedly, but that's another issue that I don't need to waste time on.
And it doesn't relate to a claim on the third cause of action.
Hmm?
And it doesn't relate to a claim in the third cause of action.
They haven't alleged it in their pleadings.
Okay.
They have not alleged it in their pleadings. And they have had ample opportunity. I mean, this is an amended pleading as it is that we're dealing with here. And so they can talk about it all they want, but they haven't alleged it in their pleading. And in their pleading only talks about fraud in the inception. And that's what this writ is about. And that's what Judge Freeman's ruling was about. Fraud in the inception that they believe relates to a claim because somehow when you buy an insurance policy, that relates to a claim. That seems to be their interpretation. When I buy an insurance policy, even if I never file a claim, the mere act of buying it relates to a claim. That's the problem with their interpretation. That's presumably why Judge Freeman determined there was an ambiguity, by the way. And on your point, Judge Hardesty, to me it's obviously a patent ambiguity because it's either on its face or it's not. Judge Freeman seemed to believe it was on its face a patent ambiguity. As I said before, I don't think it's ambiguous. I think it's clear that their interpretation is wrong. But since we're presuming that their interpretation is in good faith, then there's a patent ambiguity there. And as such, and Judge Freeman finding as such, then the third cause of action, Mr. Dreitzer could easily be right on that point, but as the third cause of action would need to be either eventually amended or dismissed. I mean, I have sued many companies over the years for fraud, misrepresentation, and Nevada pleading requirements are clear. Any fraud or misrepresentation must be stated with specificity. There can be no argument against that. Even Seneca can't argue against my point in saying that. The only pleading of this on this cause of action that they made dealt with the inception and the application. It didn't deal at all with the claim.
Well, that's not quite what I understood when he was explaining. The depositions demonstrated, I thought, otherwise.
Well, I completely disagree with him, and I think that that Seneca's own actions, to a certain extent, have proven they don't really believe in their fraud claim, even though they are putting it forward. And I'm not accusing Mr. Dreitzer of anything because he's not first chair, if you will, in this case.
The fact that they're still in this litigation, like you say, they're going to have to amend their third answer, complaint, whatever. Doesn't that weigh against us weighing in? Since most of these issues are probably capable of being resolved during the course of your litigation or can readily be addressed at the end of your litigation?
Well, either the law is, which I think it is, clear on its face, and Judge Freeman, while finding ambiguity, decided not to impose the legal requirements, or they aren't. In this case, I believe they are. I think Mr. Leverty's pleadings, in fact, prove they are over and over and over again. And so, in that regard, I think the result of this action either has to be that Judge Freeman forces Seneca to clearly and unambiguously state what fraud they're claiming now exists, which they've never done, or dismiss the cause of action.
But they could do that, right?
But they,
in the absence of us taking any action at all, they could still do that.
But they haven't. All this time, this case has been going on for years, and they haven't. The alleged discovery, which Mr. Dreitzer is claiming today, happened a long time ago, and they haven't. I mean, Seneca makes all kinds of claims, but they don't follow up. Okay, Seneca has had the pipe, which I've asked to look at because I've never seen it, and presumably could have had it tested. For all I know, they did have it tested that would deal with the fraud claims, but I guess they haven't. There's all kinds of, in other words, they can sit here and they can boast and they can claim this has happened and that has happened, but they haven't backed it up with actions. I mean, you know, the old saying, actions speak louder than words. Here, words in district court actions. Their actions don't back up their words today. See if I have anything else I want to address. No, I think that covers it, unless the court has any other questions for me.
I think so. Thank you, Mr. Karp.
Thank you, Your Honor,
for your arguments and your briefing. The case will stand submitted.